RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
That was the sound of goats being herded, ready for milking, down in the valley below me. I'm sitting high up in the hills, about an hour from the bustle of Malaga, on the southern Spanish coast. This is the furthest I've travelled to record one of these interviews, but somehow the vivid colours surrounding me are highly appropriate, as my guest today is the celebrated textile designer, Georgina von Esdorf. In the opening statement of her book, Sensuality, Art and Fabric, it says, "Life should hold purpose and delight for everyone. Our purpose becomes illuminated, lighting up our dreams and illustrating the road ahead. Art, design, print, fabric, colour, texture, movement, light, beauty, quality, vitality, freedom. This is not work. It is the way of life we choose to live. Enrichment through artistry, inspired by living." Well, I think you will find that this extraordinarily candid interview will delight and enrich while giving an insight into a woman whose life has been about having fun in the highs and lows of the fashion world.
You were born in Peru, Lima. What sort of effect did that have on you?
None at all, no. I wish I'd been born in Birmingham, really.
No, come on, seriously. Okay. I mean, what memories do you have of Peru? I mean, I'm thinking so much of what you did later is about colour particularly, and a vivid selection, juxtapositions of colour. Did Peru have that sort of embedded in your head as a child?
I think definitely it did, because the most wonderful things about growing up in Peru was the quality of the light. It's so bright. It's unlike any light that you might have in England, and it's never veiled. It's always very clear, very bright, and the use of colour there is very interesting, because they use bright colours, but they also use them in combination with very earthy tones, as browns, the colours of the llamas and the can't remember. Anyway,
how long were you there, in fact?
Until I was almost six. We spoke Spanish at home, and my father and mother went there the beginning of the 50s for my father to work for a mining company that was an American mining company that wanted to set up an office in Lima. So he was working by and large in Lima and doing a lot of traveling in the Andes. And both of my parents went there without speaking any Spanish at all and learnt it on the hoof. My parents went there with my two eldest brothers. And then during that time, my third brother, one just above me in years, was born, and myself. And we stayed there until 1960.
And when you were there as a small child, did you draw a lot? Did you have a natural artistic flair? Did your parents have any sort of creative sort of traits at all? I mean, how did that all start?
I always drew, not very well, but I always drew. And I remember one of my very, very first influences was my mother had brought on a way through New York on the way to Peru. They flew by plane to New York and then took a boat from New York down the Panama Canal into down to Peru. And when my mother was in New York, she bought the Charles Eames cards, the called the House of Cards.
I know, yes.
And they were hugely influential on me. And I remember looking at them constantly and then collecting all the sort of things that they had on the cards, and the sort of reels of cotton and drawing pins and bits of wood and tape measures and so on. And from a very early age, I used to collect sweetie wrappers and make things from sweetie wrappers. And I always liked anything that sort of shone and was twinkly.
So like a magpie.
Yes. And I collected all sorts of things, and I used to sort of put them in boxes and so on. And use them sometimes, just look at them most of the time.
And so when did you return? You obviously, you said the age of six, I think. That you
Well, just but just before I was six, yes.
And then you came back to live in England.
Yes.
Yes. And so what happened then?
First of all, we went to live with my grandparents, my mother's parents, in Wiltshire, in Marlborough. Mm. And whilst my mother actually looked for a house in London. I think we were living a little bit in London because I remember my mother being terribly unhappy there and crying a lot because it was dark and gloomy and London in the early 60s wasn't a very particularly jolly place. It certainly hadn't been in the 50s after the war, but it hadn't revived much at that point. And she was very unhappy and I think missed the light and the freedom. And we all had to be inside and, you know, wear lots of clothes. Because I remember that in Peru, we were always sort of very lightly dressed because the weather was always beautiful. Mm. I think I only ever saw rain once there. And otherwise, we were sort of lightly dressed apart from when we went up into the Andes when it got cooler at night. And in England, it was suddenly very shocking to be having to wear sort of Wellingtons and coverings. And my mother was terribly unhappy. Anyway, I think basically my father, who was often travelling and continued to travel throughout his entire life, I think because of his father, he did a lot of travelling as well. He went off and continuing on the business he was doing at the time. And my mother found a house completely on her own in Holland Park, in a road called Lansdowne Road. And in those days, I think in the early 60s, I think the house was £11,000 and she bought it. And she, my father was away and she managed to buy the house and so on. And it was just opposite her best friend from Oxford, also called Audrey.
To art school, really, and I want to know how you arrived at that point. When did you suddenly realise that that was the path you wanted to take?
When I was at school and finishing school, I was going to go in two directions. One was drama and the other one was art.
Finishing school? Tell me a little bit about that.
No. Not at finishing school. Finishing school.
I thought, my goodness me, this is... I thought you were going to say you were a debutante as well. Okay. When you finished school, yes?
Mm. I tossed a coin because
really?
I couldn't decide whether to go to drama school.
Yeah.
I did drama right the way through school.
Right.
Or to go to art school because I was in love with the art teacher. And don't put that in. And just in case he hears it. And I thought, I'll go to art school. Anyway, I tossed the coin.
Really?
And
you literally tossed the coin between drama? I suppose it's both very highly creative areas. Mm. So the coin determined your future life?
Yes.
The coin?
The coin.
Is that your kind of attitude to life?
Yes.
Tossing coins?
Yes.
Okay, so you get to art school. And how did you find that? How did you find that world?
Disappointing. Disappointing initially because my art teacher at school was so inspiring and I didn't find any of the teachers as inspiring as he was. And I remember one of the other students coming up to me saying, you know, don't look for that kind of thing. You know, don't look for it to be repeated. You'll find something else. And he was absolutely right. And I then proceeded to drop my thoughts of how I was taught and thought I was just very lucky to have had the teaching that I did have.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it. I mean, because I'd first gone to St. Martin's and I absolutely hated it there.
What were you doing? Was that a foundation?
Yes.
Sort of affair.
Yeah.
So how did you find that foundation year where you were sort of dipping into different areas? How did you suddenly sort of start to find a direction?
Well, I did two foundations. I won at St. Martin's and then one at Camberwell.
Right.
And when I went to the one at Camberwell, I concentrated mainly on painting because I thought that that's what I wanted to do. I'd always wanted to be a painter. And by the time it got to deciding what I should be doing for a degree, I started behaving very headless chicken and I started running completely wildly to one from one art school to another, thinking I was going to do ceramics or graphics or bookbinding or jewelry, or I couldn't make up my mind. I thought, well, I could actually do anything. I decided I didn't want to do painting because I looked in the painting department and they all looked a bit miserable to me. So I thought, no, that doesn't look like much fun. And seeing as fun has always been my number one preoccupation, I thought, no, that didn't look fun. And I remember looking at the textile department in Camberwell and thinking, God, they're always covered in dye. Did they ever get clean? And they were sort of up to their armpits in green and purple and all that. And there was always an evil smell coming up from the basement of the college and so on. But so I thought, oh, not that. Anyway, at the very last minute, I decided that I would do textiles at Camberwell because at that time there was a very artistic approach to all levels in every department at Camberwell. They were very much about finding your voice through all sorts of aspects of the arts. And so it wasn't entirely focused on just looking at textiles. We'd be looking at theatre, we'd be looking at architecture, and all sorts of different disciplines before we decided on what we were going to produce through the textile medium. And so it was a very interesting and broad approach to that particular thing, to textiles. And also they taught you how to understand the use of dyes and how they affected the fibres of fabric and how to completely produce a design from start to finish. And so it was it had all the sort of technical side of it.
And it was there, of course, that you met who was to be one of your future partners, and that was Martin Simcock. And then later you teamed up with Jonathan Docherty. And I know that, I think in 78, you sort of started in a small way in your parents' garage in Wiltshire with a £500 donation from the Crafts Council. How did that, just tell me that leap from leaving art school to sort of starting in a small way, producing your own fabrics.
When I left Camberwell, I got a number of jobs doing things within textiles, but on a very casual basis. And I was putting designs into repeat for a studio which worked for Liberties. And I never put a design into repeat. I think I only ever washed up the pots, actually, the paint pots. That's right. And anyway, I watched other people doing it. I still can't do it now, but I'm not very good at that. But still, anyway, and then I started working as a freelance designer, designing on paper, and my work went into a portfolio, which was then taken around the world and to various areas of America and Japan and Europe and so on, and sometimes sold and very often not sold. In fact, I was extremely unsuccessful in that area. I think, by and large, my work was highly individual, and I never went with trends. And so my work was really in the portfolio to provide a shock for clients. And they always bought the next design to mine, but never mine. So I think when they were looking through the portfolio, they saw one floral after another, and then came upon one of mine, and it was and then they immediately loved the next design after that. So I used to come back, and one year I sold one design, and the greatest level of designs I sold doing that activity was 10 in a year, and I sold them all to Liberty.
Well, that's a very good place to start.
Yes,
certainly.
But it wasn't terribly lucrative. So I decided that...
Quite prestigious, I would have
prestigious,
thought.
Prestigious, yes, prestigious.
So a very good start. And so then a little later you join forces. I mean, in 81 you join forces with Jonathan and Martin. And a little later, 3 years later or 2 years later, you actually embarked on a much more serious endeavour by borrowing, I think it's £30,000 government loan. Yes?
Yes.
How did you get that? I mean, that seems quite outrageous, really.
Well, it was a government-guaranteed loan, which was on offer for small businesses, where the government guarantees 80% of the loan. And you have a year to spend the money in, and we applied for it actually. I mean, we surprisingly did get it, and at the time I think there were quite a few people receiving these loans, and I think we got it because we had shown that we were able to sell our things, albeit on a very small level, but each time we sold, each year we doubled the sales and doubled the sales and doubled the sales. Mm-hmm. So we were, you know, we were on going in the right direction.
So at that time, just before this loan, how were you sort of manufacturing the product? Was that farmed out, or were you experimenting yourself printing?
Well, after I'd done that freelance period, I realised I wasn't going to be very successful doing that. And also I didn't like just doing one part of the process, i.e. just doing the designing. I thought, having had the experience at Camberwell of learning about dyes and all that sort of thing, I thought I really wanted to get stuck into printing myself. So that's when I went to stay with my parents, and they'd moved from London to the countryside, and we made the workshop with Martin. Yep. And I started printing on my own, making all the screens out of wood and developing them all myself, mixing all the dyes, you know, doing all the washing and all that in my parents' bath, and making a great mess there. And they were very long-suffering. And we started, like that, producing fabric by the meter, thinking that we'd just take it round to dress designers and that they would love it and make clothes out of it immediately. And then the quantity of fabric we'd get farmed out within the industry. But that wasn't to be, because, of course, like anybody, any designer has their own idea about what they want on a piece of fabric or whatever. And so although people were receptive, they didn't really want what we were doing. And they'd sort of say, well, can we have that, but not like this and not like that? And I was very determined that what I wanted to do and the designs I wanted to do were sort of desirable in their own right. So we cut out selling to designers on the whole, although we did get a commission to do something for Caroline Charles, which was a sort of huge thing in the early days. Yeah. And we started making products initially out of the fabrics, but we printed them all ourselves.
So what were those products, scarves and...
We started off with ties.
Ties
we did, and scarves. Mm-hmm. And I remember the very first commission we got was from Asprey. And it was agonising, actually, because we had to print their logo onto the scarf, and that was done at the very last moment. So we were doing square scarves in wool, which had our very first design that we reproduced, which was called Poppy. Mm-hmm. And that design went on and on and on, being successful right throughout the whole 25-year period that we worked, and we kept reproducing it. Anyway, we did that design for them, but right at the end, we had to put their logo onto it, which is with a tiny little screen and a tiny little squeegee to put the colour through the screen. And if we botched it, that was it. The whole scarf was ruined. Oh, so you can imagine what agony that was. Yes. I mean, that was a really ulcer-inducing period. So, but anyway, we got the commission to do that for Asprey, so that was very good.
So then when you were moving a little forward and you had this loan, what did that enable you to do?
Well, we started looking for another premises, because originally the idea had been that we would just do the samples, then we'd take them to the industry, and the industry would then produce the meterage, the yardage and so on, and then we would make up the products and stuff. Well, that wasn't to be, because at the time, the industry we found to be very conservative. They didn't want to produce the kind of fabrics we wanted to use. We were very forward-thinking, and we wanted to experiment with materials and so on. And so we found that we were going to have to produce the materials ourselves.
Yes, because I think I read that you found working with external producers, printers, so forth, just a big compromise. They wouldn't go that extra mile. They had their industry standards, and that prevented you from really doing what you had in your head. So I suppose inevitably it led to you wanting to have total control over the product, you know, making mistakes, experimenting, whatever. Was that the real kind of reasoning behind getting this thing all under one roof?
Yes. Yes, and also we realised that, well, our very first trade fair was in 1983, and we took our products to Paris, to the Paris Fashion Week, and we had, I think, three designs or something, and those three designs or four designs, and we did them all in sort of multi-colourways because we didn't have the money to produce masses of screens, make screens, because every screen cost a certain amount, and it was, you know, we were very much functioning on a budget. And we took the scarves that we had and we got orders for those. And then we got them manufactured, so-called, by someone within the industry. And they came back and they were all wrong. And when I questioned the printer about the colours, they said, well, that's a commercial green. I said, well, we wanted an emerald green and you've produced a forest green. I said, well, that's a green, isn't it? Green's a green. So we knew we were in trouble. So we had to do our own thing. And actually, we learnt an enormous amount from doing it. And it was a very exciting period when we were doing our own printing, because it was at that point we then started having other people working with us and so on. And by and large, the people that came to us hadn't had any experience of printing themselves, and we taught them what to do and so on. So it was a very interesting, productive.
And it also is a very traditional... I mean, you know, I think of William Morris and that sort of thing. I think it hadn't changed really that much in terms of producing. I mean, I know with you particularly, you always like, you want to experiment with new types of fabric, introduce, you know, various elements that you wouldn't normally expect to find in materials, you know, slate and glass and beads and wire and steel and all those things. But the basic making of a fabric and the screen printing is very, I mean, it's so traditional. So, I mean, when you brought in these various younger people to work on in your workshops, how many did you sort of have? How did it develop? Because I think at one point you had quite a number of staff, didn't you, towards the latter part of the company?
Yeah, we had 40.
Yeah,
we had 40, including us, and that was a sort of rash moment in the history of the company, actually, because when we realized that we couldn't sustain that, because we had to hit sort of buffers with sales at the time, because suddenly fashion changed and so on, and we had to cut back, and we cut back to, I think eventually we cut back to 8, we realized we were actually producing approximately the same amount with 8 people that we had been when we had 40. But it's a common practice, I think, when something's going very well.
Well, I mean, that leads me... I mean, that's quite a dramatic change. And it leads me to ask you, in terms of the three of you, the trio that ran GVE, and you were very much the creative head of it and the visionary, how did you break down the responsibilities between the three people? And also, did you sit down together and have a plan?
We did have a plan. The plan was a number of words that we put down on a piece of paper. It wasn't a plan that had a vision for 5 years development and 10 years and then, you know, where we were going to be at sort of 15 years at all. And in fact, we had my father in particular, who was very intrigued by this enterprise, asked us to write down the components of what we were trying to achieve on a piece of paper. Which we then did, and it was a series of words we decided to put down, and we showed it to him.
Tell me about the words. I mean, because I noticed also that a lot of your work is inspired by words, by poetry in particular. So is that something that you get, you know, a particular buzz out of, and you can relate that to your work? And also, if you're talking about a business plan, it's quite an interesting way of putting a plan together to have a series of words. What sort of words were they?
Well, they were words like beauty, challenging, diverse.
Well, challenging diverse sound like business buzzwords.
Well, they might have been, they weren't then.
No,
they were never
no.
then, you know, no. and this was whenever it was, a sort of when we started out in the 80s, they weren't using those kind of words then,
no,
you know.
No.
Mysterious, sensual, exotic, exuberant, and vitality, truth, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Did you use those for the bank manager or just sort of for a general kind of a vision of the company?
Well, we used those for us, and then we also told the bank manager, of course, this is what we were trying to achieve, and that what we wanted to do was inspire others and stimulate other people, and stimulate, you know, by doing something stimulating ourselves, that we would be passing on this thing to other people. And I think actually we really achieved that. So I feel that we achieved absolutely everything on the list. But of course, what was missing, as my father so rightly pointed out, was any mention of money making at all. In fact, we showed him the list and he said, ah, there's something missing here. And so he said, OK, Georgina, what's missing on this list? I went, holidays? He said, no. Jonathan, what's missing? He went, motorbiking? No, no, no. Martin, lots of breaks for good lunches and long, you know, sort of delicious wine. No, no, no. Anyway, he was very, very, you know, sort of strict about the whole thing. And he was laughing, but he was also very, you know, earnest about it. He said, you've got to put money-making on your list, otherwise you won't make any. Because unless you have it as an objective, you actually won't make it. But we never put it on the list, and we never really did make it, because even at the height, when we were turning over 6 million, which
yes,
is at the time...
Yes, I was going to say, I mean, at one point, you had 300 retail outlets in 20 countries, and you were a multi-million pound business.
Mm.
So obviously money did figure on the agenda, whether it was planned or otherwise. Obviously, what you were creating was clearly hitting the right note, and it must have been very, very gratifying to see that your efforts from those early days, you know, coming to fruition and people wanting your work, and indeed everyone from princesses to pop stars, Lady Diana to David Bowie, were wearing your work. So that must have been a great moment for you. And you were featured in many, many magazines and were highly regarded. So what was it like to get to that point, having worked so long and hard?
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, the thing is, I never really... Of course, it's great when people who have their own reputation like your work, but to me, it wasn't about that. It was mostly in the endeavour of what you were trying to achieve was something you enjoyed and you put your heart and soul into. That anybody wanted to have it and to wear it. It was a thrill. So it still continues to be.
Okay, well, let's, whilst we're on that subject, all these people wanting your work and it being so successful, what is it about your work? Can you put your finger on what it is that's special about your work? Is it the fact that it's unpredictable? It's not. I think you describe yourself early on when you were first getting into the business that you found a real boring predictability, a staticness about fabrics, and that they were lacking vitality and flow. Is that, do you think that that was the special quality that you brought to the world of textiles?
I've always loved and been very sort of drawn by rhythm in music and in all sorts of things, in nature and so on and so forth. And so, and you know, our lives are full of rhythm. Mm. What I found in textiles at the time certainly was a kind of plodding nature of the sort of a repeated image, which actually, once you'd caught on to the repeated image, you could then trace it. And there was a certain sort of predictability about that. And, you know, when you'd lie in a hotel bedroom and look at the wallpaper and it go plinky, plonky, plinky, and then you'd see it and then, you know, you knew where it was going. But with mine, I always liked the idea that it moved and tremendously. So even though the surface of it, when it was on the print table, was completely, let's say, by and large, it was flat. When the print went onto it, where's the book? I'm going to show you an example, okay? Okay, this is my very first...
I mean, while you're doing that, I've looked through the very book we're looking through now, which is the work of Georgina's, and has really a collection of virtually everything you've done, I think. It's every page is different.
Did you read that?
This is your... The
statement.
The statement.
Did you read it?
Yeah, I did read it.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, you see that. You see that although it might sound corny, is the soul of what we were trying to do.
Well, I've used part of this in my introduction. So I think everyone will understand what that is when they start this recording. But basically, inspired by living is the end sentence.
Rather than being dead.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that's, no, I mean, everything you said about, you know, the rhythmic quality.
He wrote this. He wrote this and
Martin,
we...
Martin,
yes.
Your partner. So this was...
Because Martin,
way, I guess this
Martin
is your,
writes poetry.
Yeah. So this is... This would be, you know, these days referred to as a corporate statement, but it's much more beautiful
word for that, because that's
much more.
And when I do teaching, I always start. Well, first, I don't completely always start with that because it's a bit full on, but I, I always read this because I want the people, the students, to understand that it incorporates many things. Mm. And
but what this book demonstrates is the fact that you know that no two things are the same. I mean, you cannot put your finger on your work, really, apart from the fact that it's ever changing, and uses, you know, just incredible combinations of colour, which I think is a rarity, and also textures. Mm-hmm. There's a tactile quality, colour in terms of how it reacts to light, all those things, and then you suddenly go to very simple, almost minimalistic things. Mm. So there's, I mean, it seems to me that. Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a scarf here called Lupin, which is really, in terms of its design, very simple, almost a series of seeds on stems, but with beautiful, beautiful colours and a luscious sort of fabric, which I think is, what is this fabric?
It's rayon velvet.
Velvet, yes, which is I know, something that you particularly like. And you know, printing on it, getting these very subtle colours, obviously takes an enormously long period of time. I noticed that further on in the book you've got these little swatches. You obviously spent ages sort of mixing colours and just putting combinations together.
On this page it shows the velvet with these particular colours, which are sort of greens and yellows and browns and
very natural colours.
Natural colours, yeah, on a black ground. And then on the other page it shows, this is the chiffon print of it,
yeah,
which is then on
light,
a sort of
airy,
light and airy, very sort of vermilion with
and
blue
sort of lilacs and
yeah, exactly. And this is a Devore, which is a satin and chiffon fabric. So in fact it's like a stencil, or what do you call it? Would it be a stencil,
yeah,
when you've taken all negative,
yeah,
of the design? So all the colour is removed, and basically
it's in the
process, yeah, of this. So what happens is you produce this with a paste, you print through the screen,
yeah,
and the paste eats away the surface layer, which is the satin, and reveals the chiffon below, and then you can dye it once to dye the satin and once to dye the chiffon. So you can do that in two colours, or it's multi-purpose.
About the use of other items that you started to sort of fuse into your work?
That came a lot later.
Yes, I think we'll get to it here, where you've got chiffon slate and nylon wire and twisted ribbon, and you've got steel washers and blue dots and rubber and slate. Was that just what led you to start experimenting there? I suppose you'd done everything with fabrics.
Well, this period was when Martin was an external assessor for a number of different colleges, and he went to Loughborough year after year, and there he met two particular students who he invited to come and work with us. And that work is the work of one of the students who stayed with us and then formed part of the design team and then worked on the embroidery area. So those were inspirational pieces which she had done and came from her portfolio. And at the time that this book was published, she just joined us. And Thames and Hudson were very keen to use those images as a way of, and so were we, as a way of progressing, showing the progression where we were going.
Yeah.
And she, who is called Bridget Morell, is now married to Martin, and known as Bee. And she sort of pioneered the area of the embroidery and so on within GVE.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I was just going to show you the very first design, just to illustrate the point of movement. That design was the very first design.
Yeah, it's the first Georgina von Essop design to be featured on the cover of Vogue.
Yeah, and I did this design when I was at college, and then we reproduced it in 1981 in repeat like this in the figure of eight.
Yes.
And it can also be produced this had a border screen that fitted around it, and that was on chiffon, and it was also reproduced as fabric. And with that, what I wanted it to look like was that when you printed it and it lay on the table, if you were to look away, it would start to move. start to move. Okay. And then when you looked again, it had come back to its formation like this. So it looked like it was constantly moving. And that was always my pleasure to do with the designs. And in fact, when other designers started to work with us, you can tell, people who know my work can tell which is my work and which is the work of other designers.
Right.
Because my work always has this fluidity.
So we've got to a point now where you're very successful. You've got a multi-million pound business. And I want to know what the pressures were like running a large enterprise, because I read that when you were at that point, you felt that you were channeling less energy into your brain, and you felt that there was a kind of a split going on. What was that? What happened? What was happening there? Were you just being taken away from what you really wanted to do?
I think when you first begin something, there's a terrific excitement that, to see whether or not the thing that you feel so passionate about is going to be well received. And there's an enormous buzz that comes from putting the thing that you do, your heart and soul into it, and then putting it into the market and seeing what happens. And of course, we were very lucky and it seemed to hit the spot and so on. And there was a tremendous energy that came through from that. And we were determined at the same time to enjoy ourselves doing it. And that was what, that was basically what...
Okay, so at the time that there were these additional outside pressures happening around the business and you were taken away from, or you felt you were being taken away from, what you're really there for.
Yeah, I didn't answer that question, actually.
No.
Because in the first 10 years, everything was fine.
Yeah.
And we did exactly what we wanted. Mm-hmm. And we'd hit the spot. And everybody, our sales were going from one year to the next. They were doubling and they were trebling and they were going. We'd obviously somehow managed to, without really having a plan, in fact, at all. As I said, we didn't have the 5-year plan, the 10-year plan, but it seemed to be going terribly well. And we just did what we did and we didn't really think about it. We just did exactly what we wanted.
Mm.
We had huge fun doing it. And then after 10 years, our first employee, who was 17 when he joined us, he was killed in a car crash. And he was at that time, my assistant. And it sort of was like a watershed moment.
Mm.
And suddenly the fun, as it were, the sort of fun element changed. And the sort of door seemed to open on a different period where we became more concerned about what would sell and what wouldn't. I think it also was at a time when there was a bit of a recession, I think in the early 90s.
Yeah.
There was a recession and we had a difficult time then. But we were determined not to let the recession get to us, because we'd always thought that when you have a recession, you've got to try even harder and be even bolder and not draw in horns, but actually stick your neck out. And so we did. And that succeeded. But during that time, there was a lot of pressure on us individually. We all felt very devastated by the loss of this young guy who was like a bit like a son to us. We loved him, and he was he's sort of golden boy, very wonderful, very talented. And then, yes, we hit this recession and it all became a bit more serious. And it was difficult, really, because, we all three were designers. Jonathan was a product designer. Martin was in textiles. And like me, his speciality was weaving more than printing.
Yeah.
And I had done printing and etching.
Mm.
And Jonathan, product design. And so, none of us were actually business orientated. We were all interested in design. That had been our main focus and remained the focus forever. And in actual fact, I think that's what really bound us together during all the horrors of our 25-year, it wasn't horrors by all the time, of course not. But when we did have horrors, I think that what bound us together and what sort of kept the respect going was our passion for design, our passion for artistry, creativity, our belief in that can sort of conquer all, and the love we had for it and all that kind of thing. Sounds very corny, but...
Well, but I mean, the other fact of the matter is, I agree totally with what you're saying, but there is a point where you're running a larger concern that there are other pressures, i.e. everybody's salary, everybody's general livelihood, they have mortgages and so forth. So there are other pressures that kind of nibble around the edges, which kind of become a kind of reality check, that you can't just have endless fun. You're responsible for people. And that does, I think, ultimately start to add pressure and maybe sometimes make you do or enter into things that you don't necessarily want to. Did you find that was happening to you? Did you just carry on in the same sort of spirit?
No, the pressures were mounting, really, because I think the thing was that we were all passionate about design, but the passion stopped when it came to really the business side of it. And my partners, I think, were fantastic in taking on the sides of the business which weren't automatically, you know, of interest to them, leaving me with the sort of artistic direction, let's say. I mean, we all did selling. But the administration and looking after people and so on, we all did that to a great extent. And of course, you know, running the business, we all did that to a certain extent as well. But me, much less than the other two. And we fell into roles, which was, and my role never changed. I was always the sort of artistic director and so on. And Martin became the sales director, and Jonathan the production and overall sort of managing director. And I think those sort of pressures did start to get to them and to us all. And also then when we had a recession period, and we lost our friend. I think there was somehow doubt crept in as to whether we were doing the right thing and perhaps we ought to think more about our customers and perhaps what they wanted. And up to that point, we never thought about them, really. We thought, we'll do what we really love. And if that hits the spot for people, which it's bound to with some people, then that's a wonderful way of doing what you do and doing it well. And then we started to introduce this area of doubt, which was, is this what, you know, the market requires, and might they want something else, and all that element of doubt. And of course, that sounds very arrogant, as if we weren't ever thinking of our customer. We were. We did think of our customer. But we thought the best way to reach the customer is to do something that's very true to yourself. And then that would translate itself to the customer. And then, of course, once you introduce the element of doubt, then you start getting a bit wobbly and so on. And we had we did have some difficulties, and sometimes we didn't make the right decisions. And that became then a different sort of impact. And then we brought people into the business on the sort of consultancy level, and then we brought people in to sit on our board as non-executives, and then we made a chairman.
I'm interested in that, because the moment you bring other people in, they have their own kind of agendas going on, and they may not be creative, they may be business people, they may be PR people, whatever. That means you end up having kind of formal meetings, and the kind of naivety of when you set out and the kind of organic way in which you often will run a company, which is a kind of spirit, turns into a much more formal affair. And can have an effect on, you know, how you think and how you feel. So having these additional people in, whether they were non-executive directors, whatever, did that, because many companies have to do that, how did that, because it strikes me, you know, reading about you and knowing you, you know, you are an intuitive person, not somebody that readily likes the idea of working within a rigid structure. But there you are now with a company that is, a lot larger, needs a bit of harnessing here and there. So how did you fit into that, you know, in with board?
I'm very bored at the board meetings. But anyway, we went from having sort of a meeting a month to having a meeting every day. And it then became really arduous, you know, it went from one extreme to another. Having always sort of just gone along and sailed on and said, yeah, we'll do this, great, yeah, let's get on with it.
And would this be sort of cash flow meetings, which are usually the kiss of death to anyone?
Yeah, cash flow meetings.
You spend your nights sort of awake, worrying about whether you're going to...
Exactly, and the amounts of paper we generated. I mean, we've now got a barn full of files which have meeting after meeting and, you know, resolutions for X, Y, Z to do so and so, and then what happened when they didn't, or when they did and nothing, you know, nothing good came of it and all that kind of thing. So we went to from one point of really being very much sort of doing everything on the hoof to doing everything by the book. And it was I tell you what, it talk about losing, kind of tending to lose your girlish laughter. It was pretty much like that. And I remember thinking, God, it's not fun anymore. It's just, and we were all totally, as I say, dedicated to fun. Mm. And it became quite arduous. And then when we brought these other people in, then they wanted to put a structure in that was, and we also thought, yeah, we need more structure. We haven't got any. Everything had developed incredibly sort of organically, and we never laid down any rules. And I mean, it was very hit and miss, and we were lucky because it was mostly hit, you know, at the beginning. And then, then I think the time when we brought in a chairman, and then there were various other people who came in, and they all had ideas about how we could run it. And at one point when we were turning over that 6 million, we had discussions with someone who was going to sort of buy, you know, maybe buy the business and all that kind of thing, and release us to do the design and all that sort of thing. And we didn't take that decision, and I goodness knows why we didn't, because afterwards we thought maybe we should have done, because that was the height of our thing, and we probably would have sold the company at quite a, you know, tidy sum.
It's an interesting thing, because it happens to so many companies. They seem to get to a point and they step over that mark, and in doing so all of that kind of wonderful energy just dissipates, and so many companies just change so much that they can never quite get it back again. And, you know, there's a classic example of a record label called Rough Trade, who started off in just a shop with a pile of records, and they had a few groups in, and they said, why don't we, you know, record? And they had this kind of deal where it split 50-50, unlike any other record company, and it turned into a multi-million pound business, but completely collapsed because of the very thing we're talking about here. So just when you're about to reach your 25th anniversary, you shut down the production and the studios. That must have been very difficult for you. What brought it to that point?
The business became slightly rocky on the late 90s. So 99, 2000, we went into a very big debt situation. In fashion, the fashion for scarves and accessories in general had completely gone, and in came a sort of very bleak period, in my view, of minimal dressing. There wasn't, you know, there was just the handbag, the sunglasses and the shoes, that was the accessories, and otherwise it was all, there was virtually no jewellery, no gloves, no interesting socks or tights or, you know, scarves or anything like that. And what replaced neckwear was the pashmina. Pashmina scarf came in, and everybody who produced scarves at the time, including Hermès, that sold scarves by the handful always, were hit by the arrival of the pashmina. And the pashmina was there for 2 years, i.e. Four seasons in dominance over everything else. And people were buying them in handfuls. And I remember I went to do a breakfast presentation in Bergdorf Goodman in front of a sort of area that had our scarves. And just before I started to address the public, they opened the doors to the public. They set up a table in front of where I was standing and emptied a load of pashminas on top of it. The doors opened, the public came in, and there I was trying to greet the public, and they were all grabbing pashmina scarves. It was just awful.
Oh, God, that's awful.
And anyway, that was a bit of a low point. So the business went downhill, and we were left with a debt of some sort of 600,000-700,000, at which point I had to sell the house that I lived in, which was an old chapel, and put the money into the business to prop it up and so on. We went into creditors voluntary arrangement, a CVA, and with an agreement to pay back creditors over a 5-year period. a certain percentage of the money that we owed them. And so we started on the long haul to pay back the money. And it was, you know, I mean, to do that, you have to be doing very well to succeed out of that hole. And we were, you know, struggling along. And then in 2001 came the September 11 and the attack on the towers, and our American business completely ground to a halt. So from having a lot of business in America, I mean, it was something like 55% of our business, it just went to nothing. And so again, we were knocked, and it was very, very hard. And we kept going. We did a whole collection that was all to do, in 2000 and 2001, it was all to do with recycling. So we didn't buy any fabrics. We made everything from what we already had in stock. We tore it up, we reconstituted it, we added other things, and it was immensely successful, really good. And we hadn't spent a penny on actually buying things in or printing things. It was all things that we'd done before and we reinvented, and it was an immensely creative period, very, very good indeed. And I'd been sort of rabbiting on for ages about recycling, and no one was particularly interested until that time when we actually had to do it. And it was good for us all, actually. And we enjoyed it. And so that did well, and we sort of slowly crept back up, slowly. And we had, at that time, we had two shops, I think. We had a shop in Burlington Arcade and one in Sloane Street. And then we decided to get out of Burlington Arcade because the rent review came up and they started to say, we want more money. And we thought it was absurd because there were a lot of places in Burlington Arcade that weren't filled. Anyway, so we left there and we moved to a shop in Ellis Street. And then we had the London attacks in 2005. And that hit our trade completely. And again, people weren't coming to London, and people weren't, you know, it wasn't just foreigners. It was, you know, people coming from the country, et cetera, didn't come to London. And our sales sank again and coincided with a sort of just difficult time all round, I think, for everybody. I mean, I had, you know, personally, I'd had some problems, and I was feeling very exhausted by those, and pretty uncreative and all that, and various other things were going on at the same time. And we struggled on, and it just became more and more difficult to produce things, and, you know, with the money that we had. And then it just became evident, you know, various times in our career, you know, we say, right, things are bad now, but we'll give it till Christmas. And if we don't succeed by then, we'll shut it down. And if we don't, and we said that a number of different times. And this time, actually, you know, it really was. I mean, we always said, oh, come on, let's give it a go. Let's give it another go. And we were, by this time, we'd been so many times in the boxing ring against the ropes. And this time, the, you know, the referee was counting. And we just thought, it's too exhausting. We haven't got the stamina to continue with all this. And at that time, we were at our lowest point of money that we owed. And so we thought, right, okay, this is the point at which to shut down the trading company and put it into administration. So in June 2006, we closed the trading company, which is called GZATC Limited, leaving the trade name Georgina von Etzdorf and all the archive and so on intact. And we had a huge sale, and it went very, very well, and we managed to pay off most of our costs and debt, and that was that.
Well, okay, let's round off now. I mean, obviously, you have a lot of fans around the world, who, and your work has become, in recent years, a little more scarce. And they'll all be missing you, no doubt. What is the future looking like? I mean, we're sitting here in El Ranchillo, which is just about an hour away from Malaga, in your lovely little farmhouse. So tell me a little bit about what you're planning in terms of getting your creative energies back and producing new work.
Well, I think as far as GVE goes, the company, we had to have a mourning period, which I think we've now had, and that has to be at least 2 years in my opinion, and it's now the third year. And now I feel the energy returning to do something further with GVE, but in a completely different way. I no longer want it to consume my life. which it did, and I'm very happy that I gave it what I did, and I had an enormous amount of fun and an enormous amount of misery as well. But it was a really interesting experience. And I feel that I'd like to do something again and maybe do something for that, which would be produced out. We wouldn't be the producers of it. I think we would get that produced outside. We would design it ourselves and sell it on the internet. We have a website, and we have, as you so kindly said and rightly said, we have many customers who still would love the products and often request these things. And so we're considering, we've already started talking about what we would do, and we do it on a small scale. And that's very exciting to think that we will revive it. So that will be happening, I think, around September time, September, October. And we'll actually produce them before that, and then we'll put them on the internet in the sort of early months of the autumn. And in the meantime, also, I have started to paint again, and which I did when I first started out in my career. I have an exhibition in June with other artists. And I've been designing for a company that produces their own furnishings and wallpaper. And I'm doing two designs for them. And I'm also doing a project called Let's Get Crafty to do with making things. Because I have noticed that people get enormous amount of pleasure from creating something themselves, and the idea is to use materials that are very inexpensive and can be found anywhere, and from those things to make products and decorations, and through that to also make friends and pass on the message of creativity. And I've already done two of those, and they've been very successful. And they seem to attract all ages, giving me immense pleasure too, because people go away then knowing how to make things which they then show other people how to make. And it's stimulating and great fun.
One last question. You've been a designer for quite a long time now. Just two points out of that. What does design, being a designer, mean to you? And is it a life you would recommend?
I would without doubt recommend it. It's a wonderful thing to have, and something that never goes away. And it, this question, isn't it? What have other people said? I want to copy them.
No, well, it's got to be from you, not from other people.
I know. I'm only joking.
Design is very much on the agenda at the moment because the word is being stretched always. And so I'm talking to a genuine designer now. I want to know, you know, what it's meant to you to be, you know, I think it was the writer, Hanif Qureshi, who said to be a designer is a good life. Mm. And being a designer myself, it is a privilege and such a great thing.
No, well, I mean, that's what I've always said whenever I do any of these, any talks and so on. And last one I did was to the Women's Institute in Downton, Wiltshire.
I think I've got to say to the listeners that this interview has been interrupted by a lot of laughter, which has been edited out, but you probably get the residue of it. It has been a lot of fun. And I think I'm going to bring it to a close now.
Well, I haven't said what it means to be a designer.
Go on then.
Anyway, as I was saying, my last appearance, public appearance, for the august body of Women's Institute.
Were they all naked at the time?
Everybody just wearing a flower pot at the time. And I, but a wisp of chiffon. The joy of being creative is never ending, because it's all around us all the time. And my senses are constantly stimulated, and that's what I use to live my life. And I think it's wonderfully lucky. So I can't imagine, well, I can imagine being something else, but I'm very, very glad I have what I have. And and I want to thank you all and just say how much I love you. And Well, and wait a minute, I want to thank my dog.
All right. Okay.
And my hamster that died.
Georgina von Estorp, thank you very much.